Today we are going to see how God prepared the earth for human habitation, as revealed in the geological and fossil record. We will begin with the formation of the earth and end at the point where plants and animals first appeared, the topic of a future talk. As with earlier talks, I accept the general timeline of events that took place in early in Earth's history, as it is understood by most scientists. We will talk a bit about why that timeline is correct. It indicates that nearly 4 billion years passed on Earth before plants and animals appeared. I agree that it seems almost incredible that we can stand here and say, as we will today, that specific things happened billions of years ago, and say it with confidence. But I believe that this reflects God's deliberate design. He planned to have his creation open up to careful scientific investigation. He did not have to do this. If God's work had been designed just a little differently, much of this history would have been hidden from view. We will see a remarkable example of this when we look at the early fossil record. So I accept it as a fulfillment of God's claim. In Psalm 19, 1-4, that begins, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the..." Excuse me, I lost my place here. "And the skies proclaim the works of his hands." As Isaiah says, "God formed the earth to be inhabited." That's this verse right here. All other planets and satellites in the universe are empty. They are devoid of life. But more than that, they have not received God's careful preparation for habitation. They are not habitable by any kind of higher life. And we will talk today about that preparation. What does a fit place for life require? Next slide, please. Here are some things that we will keep track of as we proceed. Mixing. Storms and tides help to mix up the environment, to avoid biological dead zones, and distribute food, waste, and life itself. Just lost the lens of my glass. A fit place must have effective mixing. Liquid water. All living species require liquid water to carry out life's activities. Life may survive freezing and even more severe extremes, but only by ceasing its normal activity. So a fit place definitely needs moderate temperatures. Third, available nitrogen. Every one of the building blocks of life, the nucleotides, the amino acids, requires nitrogen. Every living cell has millions of nitrogen atoms. But nitrogen is relatively rare on Earth and exists primarily as nitrogen gas. It is so hard to break apart nitrogen gas molecules that most living species cannot use it directly. A fit place for life must have nitrogen available in a useful form. Next, an oxygen atmosphere. All complex animals need a supply of oxygen. But Earth-like planets do not naturally have much free oxygen. It's always found combined with other elements, in water or in mineral compounds such as rust, unless the temperature is too high for life to exist anyway. The early Earth had almost no free oxygen. Organic nutrients. Most plants and animals require organic nutrients as food. That is food that has been prepared by some other living species. Most animals use up food faster than their cells could prepare it from simple chemicals, even if they had the machinery to do it. Therefore, organic nutrients must be made and widely distributed before animals can survive. Stable dry land. The early Earth was covered by water to a depth well over a mile. There was no permanent dry land. A fit place for land animals and plants must have stable dry land. Protection from irradiation. High energy rays that come from the sun in space can kill life in a short time. Life on land requires a way to filter out these rays in the atmosphere. Recycling and mixing of food and wastes. Life can stagnate in a number of ways. Food is used up or wastes poison the local environment. Stagnation is avoided by physical mixing and by ensuring that the food is replenished and waste is recycled. In the long run, every food source or waste product must be recycled to avoid the two extremes of starvation or poisoning. So in your mind, project yourself back 4.5 billion years to the time that the Earth was first formed. How would you go about preparing the Earth so that it is congenial to life? That is what we want to discuss today. We are entering into a battleground area between those who believe in the God revealed in the Bible and those who believe there is no such God, whom we may call secular scientists or secular evolutionists. Many, perhaps most scientists who work in the area of evolutionary biology and the fossil evidence are of or present themselves as the secular sort. And there is another unfortunate battleground among those who accept the authority of the biblical creation account, as I do, between the so-called young earth and old earth creationists. I will not say much about this, except to give some comments on dating methods and why they are valid. If you find that what I say here differs from what you have heard, I urge you to look into these things for yourself and form your conclusions as I have. Before we begin the account of the first 4 billion years, I would like to say something about how scientists determine the age of the Earth and the early fossil and rock formations. These early dates use radioactive dating. Certain elements, particularly heavy elements, are slightly unstable, and they decay into lighter elements at a predictable rate. The half-life is used to describe this decay. The half-life is the amount of time needed for half of the elements to decay. Elements with half-lives on the order of billions of years are useful to measure ages on the order of billions of years. Some of these are listed in this table. Uranium, which degenerates to lead. There's two forms of uranium and two forms of lead that it forms. The number 206, for example, is the atomic weight, which includes the sum of the protons plus the sum of the neutrons that are in the thing. Rubidium goes to strontium. Potassium goes to argon. And then some elements with shorter half-lives are used for much less ancient dates. Carbon-14 dating, which I'm sure you've heard of, is only useful for ages up to about 100,000 years. Radioactive dating indicates when rock, such as lava, solidified, provided that the rock has not been contaminated after solidifying. For example, zircon crystals that form as lava cools are useful for radioactive dating because the crystals capture radioactive uranium but not lead as they form. Let me just say flat out that I believe the half-lives listed in this table are an example of God's gracious providence. They are examples of the meaning of Psalm 19, 1-4, especially being that the modern age of science. God wants us to be able to probe how he created life. And so he arranged things so that a few elements would have decay half-lives in the billions of years. This is not the only use of these elements, of course. For one thing, the Earth's core was heated by radioactive decay since its very beginning. And that's why it was warm enough to support life from the very first. But it strikes me as much more than accidental that these elements are so useful in determining the age of ancient rocks. Now we'll go into the ages that we're going to consider tonight. The first age of the Earth is called the Hadean Age, from the Greek word Hades, which means hell. It's the period of time when the Earth first formed, became a hot, molten mass, and then slowly cooled to a temperature below the boiling point of water. The formation of the solar system and Earth. It formed about 4.55 billion years ago from the remnants of a supernova explosion. As the Sun formed from a large amount of helium and hydrogen left over from the supernova, its gravity captured many supernova fragments. Now I show here, this is actually, I wish I had a different picture. This is a picture of the Saturn with its rings. Actually, this is kind of the opposite because the rings for Saturn occurred when some satellites broke up. And so we're talking about the opposite. The Sun forms and you get a whole bunch of debris around the Sun. And then the debris is formed when the particles come together into planets. Planets quickly grew as they swept out fragments in their path. For example, you can see this ring is kind of empty. That's because it has been swept out by a moon. One of the moons is formed by what used to be there. Okay. There's about 20 or so moons in Saturn. I think that may be one of them. I'm not sure. Here's one. I don't want to
say what that slice is. I wish I had an artist's sketch of the formation of the planets.
The Earth was formed over a period of 10 to 20 million years, while larger gas planets such as Jupiter, Uranus, and Saturn took longer. We can date these events with considerable accuracy. The oldest meteorites formed when the fragments of the supernova solidified and show ages of about 4.55 billion years with an error of only about 25 million. Heat caused by impacts and radioactive decay of the heavy elements melted the early Earth. During the Hadean era, this heat was far greater than the heat provided by the sun. Melting caused the heaviest elements to sink to the core, and the lighter elements formed a thin crust. Shortly after the Earth was formed, next slide please, it collided with another planet about the size of Mars, which apparently had also formed at about the same distance from the sun. This collision was fairly late in the planet formation process, so both planets had a molten core with a solid crust. And this is obviously an artist's depiction. I don't think the cameras have not been invented at this point yet. So this is not a photograph, but it's supposed to show the Earth with a Mars-sized object, so you can get a sort of a feel for the relative size colliding with it. The melted cores combined into the Earth's core, and the orbiting fragments of crust form the moon, which accounts for the fact that moon rocks have mostly lighter elements, very similar to Earth's crust. The oldest moon rocks are about 4.5 to 4.52 billion years old, so the moon was formed some 30 million years after the solar system first formed. These moon rocks were gathered by Apollo 17, that's the United States, December 72, and Luna 20, a Russian lander, February 1972. At first, the moon was very close to the Earth, perhaps 15,000 miles away. This caused huge tides, 100 times more violent than we experience today, in both the Earth and the moon. The tidal friction stopped the moon's rotation and caused it to recede from the Earth. Even today, the moon recedes from the Earth about an inch a year due to tidal friction. Next slide, please. The moon craters give a record of the chaotic times after the moon formed. Some of the larger moon craters may have formed as its receding orbit swept up some of the large fragments left over from the original collision. This bombardment ceased about 3.8 to 3.6 billion years ago at the end of the Hadean era. The moon's visual features give the timing of these impacts. The largest features, the dark, called maria or seas, are huge lava flows from impact and partial melting. They are also the most recent features, evident by the fact they don't have a rich pattern of craters within craters that characterize the lighter color and the older moon highlands. Next slide, please. This slide, photographed during Ranger 9 in 1965, it was one of the first moon shots, and the rocket just plowed right into the moon. But as it was going into the moon, it sent back photographic images. So these shots are, here's pretty far away, there's closer yet, and boom, okay? But if you look at these, and now this is, let's see, this is the visible part from the Earth, so this is like a half moon we're looking at, okay? And the impact area is called Alphonsus Crater, which is right around here, something like that, okay? So you can see part of this mare here, and it comes down, and you can see part of this, let's see, I think that mare there, And as you get closer and closer, you see more and more craters. That's an indication of an old impact area, impacts over a period of time. Whereas if you look at the mare, this is, you know, here's a mare, and it's fairly smooth. We didn't land there, but I mean, you can see that there's not nearly as much character in the craters. Next slide is one of the most recent of the large impact craters. It's called Orientale. It's a crater that was formed about 3.8 billion years ago on the moon's far side, just beyond the western margin of the visible near side. In fact, if you look at a full moon, you can see to about here, roughly. You can see that mare. You can see these two. In fact, let's go back a couple of slides to look at the full picture of the moon. The full moon. And if you look, see those two right there? Those two impact areas right there. Now put the new one up. It doesn't matter if they're in order, because I can always get them in order later. That's these two there. Okay. So that's just right in the left margin of the visible moon. And just over that, you see this humongous crater. That crater is about 600 kilometers in diameter, which is about 400 some miles. And when I was giving my talk in Pennsylvania, it's about 400 miles from here to Philadelphia, I was saying, you know, I could have had my entire trip and been within that crater. So that's a pretty big crater. Several authors have remarked that the combination of the Earth and a massive nearby moon are needed to make a fit place for life. The tides mix up the oceans. They distribute life and nutrients. They eliminate biological dead zones and contribute to the global weather patterns. Next slide, please. At the end of the Hadean period, the Earth had a crust, but it was thin and constantly being reformed and broken up. The surface of the Earth at this time is too smooth, not enough high and low areas for permanent continents. That would be the biblical dry land. That will take billions of years to form, and we'll tell you why in a few minutes. The sky is very dark and cloudy. Violent storms and volcanoes are a constant feature due to the moon's close proximity that causes huge tidal forces to heave and wrench the oceans and the solid crust. The seas are very salty, more so than today, and cover almost all the Earth's surface. The only visible land is the tips of volcanoes, for example, something like that, that poke above the water, but they quickly erode because there are no coral reefs or other stable structures to keep them from this severe tidal action. The atmosphere has almost no oxygen. It consists primarily of nitrogen gas with carbon dioxide, water vapor, ammonia, and hydrogen sulfide in small amounts. Next slide. The Hadean period ends at about 3,800 million years ago, 3.8 billion, when the bombardment of debris and meteorites has largely ceased. This fitness scorecard shows some progress. The moon provides mixing, so the top box is filled in. There is liquid water and some, but not much, available nitrogen produced by the constant lightning, which causes ammonia and some nitrogen-containing salts to occur. There is very little oxygen. As the Earth cools from a molten state, all available oxygen gas combines to form oxides or water because hot matter very quickly uses up any available oxygen. That's what happens when you start a fire by applying heat. The fuel becomes hot enough when you apply the heat that it spontaneously combines with the atmospheric oxygen. The question then becomes, how can oxygen be put into the atmosphere, and how can a reliable supply of nitrogen and other nutrients be introduced so plants and animals can exist? This is done by bacteria. It was long assumed, not yet, not the next slide yet. It was long assumed by biologists that no actual fossils of the earliest living species would be found. The reason seemed self-evident. The first life would be simple, quote-unquote. It would be single-celled and microscopic. It would be soft-bodied with no skeletal parts, very vulnerable to destruction by heat or decomposition. The shape would be almost certainly so basic, spherical or rod-like, that it would be virtually impossible to identify the remains as biological. They could just as easily be bubbles or minute stress marks in the rock. Beside all this, there is very little early rock exposed on the surface of the earth. Most old rock has long since been pulverized by the weather or buried by younger rocks. There are only a few places where old rock remains. There are small amounts in Greenland, in South Africa, and Western Australia. So next slide now. So in the face of these expectations, it is utterly amazing that in the 1970s, the earliest known fossils were found and identified by J. William Schoepf in Western Australia and dated to 3,465 million years ago, with an error of only about 5 million years. This is almost unbelievable accuracy for such an ancient date. Schoepf discovered the fossils at the famous Bitter Springs fossil site in Western Australia, known mostly for fossils that are younger by about 2 billion years. How could the dating of these fossils be so accurate? The answer is a providential combination of events. These early fossils are sandwiched between two layers of lava that contain tiny zircon grains. The lava layers were separated in time by about 12 million years. The zircon grains had enough uranium in it that they could be dated plus or minus just a few million years. So you have two lava layers separated by 12 million years, so the fossils in between are a certain time, plus or minus about 5 or 6 million. I mean, you know, somewhere in between these two layers. This is marvelous and unexpected accuracy. Are these fossils primitive? Are they spheres or rods? Well, yes and no. As the photograph shows, they look like strings of rod-like cells that are dried up. They're shriveled, you might call them shriveled strings of cells. They appear to be cyanobacteria, also called blue-green algae. In the bottom, you see a modern example of cyanobacteria. These are moss-like species that live in oxygen-poor environments, so they don't need oxygen. They are bathed in light, such as in shallow bodies of water. They are exceedingly complex, far from what you would think to call primitive. And of course, that is one of the reasons why it took Schoepf, who discovered these things, about 30 years to convince scientists that he was telling the truth, that what he said was correct, because they were too complex to be that old. Next slide. Cyanobacteria grow in long chains because when the cells reproduce, they divide in half and tend to remain attached. Basically, what happened is, I can draw a small picture here. Here's a, they're sort of oblong, and then when they divide by kind of cleaving like this, and then gradually you have two cells, but they kind of stay stuck together. So you end up with strings of connected cyanobacteria. The cyanobacteria secrete a calcium slime which solidifies to form characteristic multi-layered dome-like structures called stromatolites, which grow in shallow water between high and low tide. So here's these are stromatolites, or modern stromatolites, and they look humongous, but I think they're all actually maybe about a foot high or 2 feet high. The camera was, since you have cameras that can blow things up, you can't really tell whether you're looking at a fly or looking at the side of a Rockefeller Center. But the stromatolites grow between high and low tide. So they're washed by the tide as the tide comes in and goes out. They would grow on the side in those ancient times. Where would you get shallow water? You would get shallow water where you had a volcano that was now eroding. And as it's eroding, it's gradually going down, and you end up with a big shelf of shallow water, and that's where the stromatolites would grow. The earliest living species had to be complex, because they had to survive on a very harsh and inhospitable Earth. This need for complexity in the earliest living species is a basic dilemma for evolutionary theory. Here are some of the problems facing the first living species. They must be protected from lethal solar and cosmic rays. They must have a source of energy to carry on cellular activity in just the right amounts, not too much or too little. They must have food, specifically sugar, to store energy and make the carbon chains necessary for life. They must have nitrogen in a useful form, as ammonia or nitrates or proteins. When you eat proteins, one of the main components you're getting is nitrogen. Actually, you're getting amino acids which contain nitrogen. They must be able to survive environmental extremes, such as freezing, famine, drying out. All of these problems had to be solved by the very first living species, which is why they had to be very complex. Let's go through these items one at a time and see how God solved the problems. The early atmosphere did not filter out harmful rays, but a few feet of water is a very good filter. So all of the early species of life lived in water for the next 3 billion years. If you look at a nuclear reactor, it's usually buried in water. I mean, it's, you know, the rods are immersed in water. I think they figure nominally about 30 feet of water is enough to take care to get rid of most radioactivity. Okay, when I was on submarines, the nuclear pile, you could walk right on top of it, and it was actually a clear plastic floor. You look right down there, see the rods right down there, but they're buried in about 30 feet of water. Yeah, and the water itself keeps the radioactivity contained. You know, it doesn't come through. So shallow water is a good way of getting rid of rays. That's why all life was in water until it was possible to filter the rays out in the atmosphere. But that didn't happen at this point. By living in rigid stromatolites, those big globs, in shallow water, they could withstand severe storm, wave and tidal activity, enjoy sunlight, and take advantage of water movement, supply fresh food, and remove waste materials. The second issue, visible light. Visible light is a good source of energy, but it's far too energetic to be useful in the subtle cellular chemistry. So the early life invented photosynthesis. This is a complex process that is built around a chlorophyll molecule. A useful picture of how chlorophyll works is to think of a pinball machine. A plunger, you think you know what a pinball machine is. You got a plunger and you hit it and it hits a ball. Okay, a plunger, which you might consider to be the photon with lots of energy, hits a ball, which would be an electron, and propels it to a very high energy state. And then the electron kind of falls back, pum 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 pum, right back to where it was before. Okay, or the ball in the pinball machine goes ding 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 ding, and finally it's back down. I had a pinball machine that I showed had with me the last time, but when I picked it up, nobody was there. I just walked into the house and picked it up. I called up ahead of time, of course. And when I delivered it, nobody was there, so I just walked into the house and delivered it. And I haven't even seen the people that I borrowed it from. Except that when Skip and I moved the piano about a month or so ago, we did it to their house, and I looked in the side room, and there was what's called a pachinko machine. It's a pinball machine, vertical pinball machine. And so I called them up and asked if I could borrow it. Sure, go ahead and borrow it. But nobody was there. I just went and picked it up. I had to walk through the house to get it and walk through the house to deliver it. So I felt a little shy about repeating that. But anyway, if you think of a pinball machine, you get the idea. You get a lot of energy, and then it comes back and does a little work as it's coming back. It hits this thing, hits that thing, hits that. That's exactly the way chlorophyll works. There's a heavy molecule, I believe it's magnesium, and the magnesium has a whole bunch of electrons around. Photon comes in, punk, hits the electron, doesn't escape because the molecule keeps it there, but then it comes back down, and as it comes down, it does work and in small amounts. The significance of photosynthesis can hardly be overemphasized. Without it, life simply could not exist on the early Earth. It has been called the most important innovation on the Earth. It is amazingly complex and intricate. It involves over 200 genes and a genetic code of 150,000 base pairs, just for the chlorophyll part of it. So if you remember the last talk, we talked about the chemical building blocks of life and then look at the minimal cell and what does it require. Well, this is the very first life we know about, and it just for this one part, just the chlorophyll, takes 150,000 base pairs. Next slide. Photosynthesis involves two steps called the light reaction and the dark reaction. The light reaction converts photons to useful energy, and the dark reaction then uses that energy to make sugar. The light reaction decomposes water into oxygen, hydrogen, and electrons. So water plus photons, your photons go pumping in, and it breaks apart water into electrons, hydrogen ions, which is plus charge things, minus charge things, and water, and oxygen is a waste product. The oxygen is not used. Photosynthesis uses electric currents to power two separate tasks. The electron current is used to make a molecule called NADPH, never mind what it is, that is part of sugar production. The proton current, now these are currents in the electricity sense. When we talk about electric power lines, we plug into the wall, you're talking about electrons, electron currents. We don't use proton currents because proton currents, proton electricity comes in water. Now, if we were living in water, we could have proton currents, but we don't live in water, we live, well, we put it in wires. Proton current powers a miniature rotary motor called ATP synthase. This is it, right here. And this is an artist's sketch, but basically, it looks like a mushroom. And the motor forms small packets of energy called ATP that are just right for the chemistry that is needed in living cells. A flow of protons passes through the motor, just like electrons pass through a motor that you think about, and makes it rotate. Under ideal circumstances, this motor rotates at up to 18,000 RPM. Now, that's about 6 to 10 times faster than a car engine. So we have this little thing going shh. Every time it turns around, every time there's a complete rotation, it produces three of these ATP molecules. Think of the ATP molecules as little chunks of energy being stored, like a little batteries, miniature batteries, okay, that are going to release their energy when it's needed. So the first step in photosynthesis, uses this rotary motor to produce chunks of little batteries that are going to be used a little bit later. Once the light has been reduced to bite-sized chunks of ATP, the next step is uses the energy to produce simple sugar. It's in fact glucose. This is called the dark reaction because it does not directly use the light photons. The light photons were already used to produce the ATP, the little chunks of energy. But this is a very complex process, and if I had time, I would go through that, but it's many, many production steps. And finally, you get sugar. This leaves the problem of getting nitrogen. Remember, we had to have food, and we had to have nitrogen, because you've got to make amino acids and things of that sort. And nitrogen gas is converted by another process called nitrogen fixing. And basically, what nitrogen fixing does is it takes a nitrogen molecule, or N2, a nitrogen gas molecule, and breaks it apart into nitrogen salts, phosphates and so forth and so on. Any fertilizer has tons of nitrogen in it. But nitrogen fixing takes a lot of energy because the nitrogen gas molecule is very tightly bound. But there's a problem here because the production of the ATP in the photosynthesis has oxygen as a waste product. Although cyanobacteria can do both photosynthesis and nitrogen fixing, these two processes cannot be done together because the oxygen poisons the nitrogen fixing process. So how can cyanobacteria make both ATP and fix nitrogen? The solution is that some of the cyanobacteria specialize. They form a thick cell wall that protects the interior of the oxygen from oxygen, and then they specialize in nitrogen production, using the food produced by the other cyanobacteria. These are called heterocysts, and you can see one here. There's a chain of cyanobacteria, and there's a thick every once in a while you'll see a thick cell wall thing. That's where the nitrogen is produced. Within the colonies of cyanobacteria, you can see bacteria specialize and share their food. They share nitrogen, sugars, and ATP. You can see why they must live in rigid colonies rather than as free living bacteria, and you can see why they grow in chains. There is one problem remaining. The early Earth had severe and sometimes sudden changes in environment. And for stromatolite colonies, the shallow tidal zones that they require are constantly changing. So the first living species had to have a way to survive in a dormant state between the times that they could flourish. The solution is another specialized cell called aconites. Aconites also have a thick wall, but they're able to survive freezing and starvation and dehydration for long periods of time. So here's an artist's depiction of cyanobacteria, and there's the heterocysts, and these heterocysts are surrounded by aconites. Those are another thick cell thing. And the aconites are almost like seeds in the sense that they can survive. The ability to survive extreme conditions is a unique feature of many bacteria, and is one reason why it's logical that bacteria were suited for the harsh early Earth. These bacteria can even survive for millions of years. A bee trapped in amber some 60 billion years ago was found to have live but dormant bacteria in its gut. This survivability of bacteria is perhaps why God chose to use bacteria to make the earth a fit place for later, more complex species. Another example is during one of the moon trips, a camera was left on the moon, and some years later it was retrieved, and it had live bacteria in it. So the bacteria could survive the vacuum of space in a dormant state. Next slide. So the very first living species recorded in the fossil record at the crack of dawn already had solved some of the most complex problems of life. How to convert light to usable energy, how to make sugars, how to fix nitrogen, how to form specialized cells, the heterocysts and the aconites, how to form mutually cooperative colonies, and how to survive environmental extremes. And in the process, they invented electric motors. And I should add, invented. And we haven't even mentioned the whole topic in the last talk, which is the central dogma, which provided the genetic code to do all this stuff. In the process of doing all this, the species produced oxygen as a waste product. The oxygen was of little direct use by these first living species. In fact, it's a poison. But without oxygen, higher life would never have been possible. This itself flies in the face of evolution because oxygen had no direct survival value to these bacteria. It's as if the Earth was being prepared for something new and different. Surprise, surprise. Here's the fitness scorecard at the end of this period. We stopped this period at 3.4 billion years ago. The main change being that now nitrogen is deliberately formed in the bacteria rather than accidentally formed by lightning, okay? The lightning, and no matter what the evolutionists tell you, the lightning does not produce enough nitrogen to really allow species to live. They have to produce their own. But of course, evolutionists are not going to like that because, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? You had to have nitrogen that was formed by humans, by living cells, but you can't have living cells until you have nitrogen. Bacteria are complex creatures, but they do not have what it takes to make plants and animals. For one thing, they can only be very small. And for another, they cannot form the multi-celled species. We will discuss the reasons later on. On the other hand, plants and animals could not have existed on the Earth at the time that the bacteria were created. So bacteria were the first living species, and their main function for the next 2 billion years was to prepare the Earth for plants and animals, a job that they continue today. Three major tasks had to be done before more advanced life was possible. These are, they had to build up, to fix the nitrogen and other organic food, build up of a stable supply of atmospheric oxygen, and creation of a stable dry land. First, we won't say much about food and nitrogen. Basically, as these cyanobacteria and other bacteria grow, they just produce more and more nitrogen and oxygen and so forth. And at this state, it's a slow job of nutrients. It's a slow job, so that that happens over billions of years. And so one job of the bacteria was to distribute ample nutrients worldwide in preparation for more complex life. Next slide, please. The early Earth's crust was poor in oxygen for reasons that we've already discussed. The Earth's oxygen was tied up in water molecules and only partially oxidized solids. For a long time, after cyanobacteria started making oxygen as a waste product, it was removed quickly by oxidizing these oxygen-poor minerals. For the first billion years, uranium absorbed the oxygen. Then most of the uranium was used up, and for the next billion years, silicon and iron soaked up the excess oxygen, forming the materials of sand and the great iron ore deposits. This process can be seen in what are called the banded iron formations, which gives a record of boom and bust cycles when the oxygen supply rose and fell. You see, this is typical of iron ore deposits. You'll see these stripes of a dark material and lighter material. The dark material is the iron-rich iron oxides. The lighter material is silicates. When the environment was... Oxygen would build up from biological activity and saturate the local environment. The bacteria would then slow down, and the supply of oxygen would gradually be converted to oxides. When the environment was rich in oxygen, red iron oxide would form. When the atmosphere was poor in oxygen, iron oxides would not form, the ocean acidity would fall, and gray silicon dioxide would precipitate out. The banded iron formations end when most of the exposed crust of the Earth was oxidized, and the oxygen rose then to a fairly stable 20 to 25% level in the atmosphere, where it has stayed ever since. You can immediately see a potential problem. Oxygen is generally poisonous to the bacteria that are the only life on Earth. As long as there were minerals to draw off the excess oxygen, things could go on. But now the Earth's crust is fully oxidized. What's going to keep the oxygen from growing to the point where life hits a stagnant plateau? We will see the answer shortly. The third major task of this 2 billion year period was the creation of dry land. This is the task that found its way into day 3 of the Genesis creation account. When the earth first cooled, the earth's crust was smooth and uniform and denser than dry land is today. It was punctuated by frequent volcanic peaks, but as a whole, the early earth was covered by oceans. Under the crust, heat convection currents developed in the interior of the Earth to carry away heat from the core. So here's the core, and heat convection currents, just like if you look, if you had a clear glass of water or a pan, you can see the heat, fire underneath, you can see the heat convection currents. And that's exactly the way it is in the core of the Earth. Portions of the crust fractured into large plates. So the crust would fracture into plates. And the plates would begin to pile up along the fractures as the currents moved them along. So if this current is going this way, this current is going this way, which is typical of boiling water, you'll see, competing currents. The crust here would tend to be pulled this way. The crust here would tend to be pulled this way. A crack would form. And then there's a tug of war, next slide, and one of the sides wins out, so the one side starts riding over top of the other. Okay. The edges of the plates that end up underneath in a collision are carried along by the mantle currents deep into the Earth's interior. As this happens, the sinking edges of the plates melt from the heat. The material with a lower melting point, of course, melts first. It also happens to have lower density. And as it melts, it rises through cracks, leaving heavier density material behind. This drawing shows the movement of the Pacific Ocean crust as it moves under the western coast of South America, forming the South American continent and the Andes Mountains. Over billions of years, remember the stuff that is melting and coming up is lower density now, okay? Because the lower density stuff melts first. As you have a mixture of stuff and you heat it up, the stuff that's the lowest density or the lowest melting point will melt first, and then it'll rise. Over billions of years, the lighter crust material rises to the surface and forms what are now the continents, composed largely of granites. Granite may seem to be pretty heavy, but it's lighter than the rest of the Earth's crust, and it tends to float on top. That's good, because in a collision with a heavier crust material, the granite stays on top. This is why dry land formed in this way stays dry. The heavier crust, called magma, remains underwater on the ocean floor. Thus today, the ocean floor crust is denser, it's heavier, than the continental crust. And we still have the plates moving, but as they move, the ocean floor bends down, the continental crust stay on top. That's why it's dry ground. That's why it doesn't get dunked. Eventually, over a course of a long period of time, there's a balance between erosion of the continents, because now you have a continent, you have dry land, but you have rain, and you have weather action and so forth, so gradually things erode. But you have erosion that gets rid of the continents, you have creation of new continental material, and eventually a balance occurs. And the balance occurred around 1.8 billion years ago, or 1,800 million years ago. So you see, the creation of stable dry land involved a long process of separating the minerals of the Earth's crust into lighter continents that can float over the denser crust material. The Earth's crust was literally pulled apart and sorted. The chemical term is called fractionation. It's what a refinery does when it separates petroleum into heating oil and gasoline. Or probably a chemist would say, what do you mean heating oil and gasoline? But you see these fractions, you see these cracking towers in a refinery, and that's basically what happens. It heats up the petroleum, and then it evaporates, and the lighter stuff goes up, and that's the way you separate out different things out of the oil. Next slide. Here's the fitness scorecard at the end of this next period. And we brought things down from 1,800 million years ago, from 3,400 million years ago. The atmospheric oxygen has been building up, and it's finally reached its 20 to 25%, which is what it has today. Fixed nitrogen and organic nutrients are being distributed worldwide, and dry land has almost reached a stable size. Okay? We're moving nicely toward a fit place for life. But as we mentioned, there is still one problem, the potential for oxygen poisoning. Because remember, oxygen is a waste product of bacteria primarily, and there's too much of it around. For a while, it was being absorbed by rust and, things of that sort. That's all done now. The crust is now oxidized, so there's no place to get rid of the oxygen. So here, next slide. So here's the situation. 1.8 billion years ago, 1,800 million years ago, after 2 billion years of preparation. The only life is still a small single-cell bacteria distributed around the world. The atmosphere contains a steady 20% of oxygen, but so far oxygen is a waste product and potentially dangerous. Stable dry land now exists. It won't change much in total size, but convection currents will move the continents around the Earth's surface, which is why if you mine in Antarctica, you'll find coal deposits, which at one time indicated it was warm. Well, that's because the continent kind of moved around over the course of long periods of time. That's also why North America and South America kind of look like they fit with Africa and Europe, because they were once together, and they've been pulling apart for a long time. Radiation keeps exposed dry land free of life. So we have dry land, but we don't have any life on it, because there's too much radiation. Life has boom and bust cycles on the local level, caused by pollution, food scarcity, and overcrowding. In other words, it's oxygen buildup, and then it sort of poisons the bacteria and it kind of dies out, and then the oxygen kind of moves away and kind of grows up again and so forth. To go on, the Earth needs a new kind of life and a shield against the harmful rays from space. Both of these innovations depend on oxygen, which up to this point has been just a potentially harmful waste product of life. First, let's look at the atmospheric shield, then we'll go on to the new kind of life. Harmful radiation comes from cosmic rays, fast-moving particles from outer space, and from solar radiation, particularly radiation from solar flares. The familiar radiation badges worn by X-ray technicians, for example, measure radiation in rems. Generally, a short-time human exposure of 500 rems or a lifetime exposure of 1,000 rems is considered fatal. For comparison, the average background cosmic radiation from space is about 400 rems per year. Solar flares may produce 200 rems per hour for periods of several days. Solar flares on this level of output occur today about once per decade. So even a single day exposed to a solar flare would be fatal to most living species. Put the next slide on. That was not part of the original talk. But I saw this on the internet just a couple days ago. I'm trying to get over here so I can see that. The Earth, the Sun, goes through sort of an 11-year cycle of low activity to high activity. Okay, it's right now at a high activity rate. In fact, if you looked at the NASA website, they have all these headlines about, you know, how we are being bombarded by a magnetic storm. There's going to be a lot of aurora borealis and all that sort of stuff. We're at our peak in the radiation cycle. This picture was taken just a month ago. And here is a solar flare. Here's the sun. If you put the Earth would be about that big. Okay? This solar flare, which is part of the current activity of the sun, this is the origin of the cosmic radiation. Because this occurs because of a tremendous explosion, okay? I mean, tremendous. I mean, the Earth would fit inside the cauldron of this explosion, okay? And tremendous explosion causing lots of cosmic rays. These cosmic rays, when they hit the Earth, can be like 200 rems per hour. 500 rems is fatal. So if you had dry land at this point, it couldn't stand a single solar activity burst. You understand what I'm saying? You needed to have some kind of a shield. It's evident that life on dry land without atmospheric protection would quickly be killed by cosmic and solar radiation. The solution that allows life to exist on dry land is the development of an ozone shield. I don't think I have a slide for this part. Is the development of an ozone shield in the upper atmosphere. Ozone occurs when oxygen is zapped by cosmic rays. But the ozone, once it exists, tends to react with the rays and prevents most of them from reaching the Earth's surface. How are you going to have an ozone shield until you have oxygen? You've got to have the oxygen first, okay? Then you produce the ozone shield. So when the oxygen levels stabilized about 1.8 billion years ago, the ozone layer began a slow buildup. And over the next billion years or so, it reached a level where it gave adequate protection to life on dry land. In the fossil record, this is about the time that the first mosses appear on land. Once it started, land life flourished and began to build up soil nutrients to support the complex plants and animals that would come later. So the first step in this period is the ozone shield, which had to be done before we could have life on Earth, on dry land. Before we could have life on dry land, complex life on dry land. Bacteria, the only life forms present to this point, do not have the basic design that's needed for complex life. A new cell type is needed, so radically different that it amounts to a new second creation of life. The new creation is called the eukaryotic cell. We talked about this back in the last talk about the chemical building blocks. And it occurred about 1.8 billion years ago. All plants and animals, by plants and animals, I mean, you know, things you think of as plants and animals, they're all multi-celled. They're all eukaryotes. Eukaryotes. It's a word that means proper nucleus. We will look at some of the unique features of this new kind of life And after we've just listed the features, we'll discuss their significance. Next slide. The most visible distinction between bacteria and eukaryotes is the appearance of a nucleus. Think of the yolk of an egg. You can generally identify a eukaryotic cell by the presence of a nucleus. So here's a prokaryote, does not have a nucleus. A eukaryote does have a nucleus. The DNA, the genetic material, in a prokaryote is just sort of in loops throughout the cell. In a eukaryote, all the genetic code is contained in the nucleus. A nucleus is only one of a number of specialized organisms, portions of a eukaryotic cell. Various organelles are found throughout the cell, each type designed to provide a local environment to carry out some particular task. For example, there's a kind of cell called organelle called a mitochondria. The mitochondria are the primary source of the cell's heat and energy. The mitochondria use oxygen to make energy, and this is the main reason why eukaryotic cells require oxygen. In addition, eukaryotic cells sometimes have other specialized features such as cilia and a gullet. We'll look at that in a few minutes. Although there are specialized structures in a bacterial cell, overall it's a much simpler structure. Eukaryotic cells also have a cytoskeleton. This is an internal structure that connects all the organelles and cell wall in an intricate web of fibers. The fibers are used for general structural support, for food transport, and for movement, including one kind of fiber that can contract like a muscle fiber. The filaments that make up a cytoskeleton are so fine that they're not normally visible in a microscope. Perhaps the most remarkable innovation in the eukaryotic cell is the use of the cytoskeleton to form a transport system that carries food and waste products throughout the cell. This is truly a motorized transport system using a molecular motor called kinesin. The kinesin motor carries cargo, food or waste, in a small sac called a vacuole and moves it along the cytoskeleton fibers to and from various cell organelles and between them and the cell wall. Kinesin motors were first observed by accident by a Dartmouth professor in 1981 when a television camera was used to view the image of squid nerve fiber under a light microscope. He was going to have a lecture, and he wanted to have it all show what the microscope looked like. So he took a video camera and stuck it under the microscope to take the pictures, okay, so that he could have his lecture and not be fiddling around with the preparation and so forth. But then when he looked at the video, and he could adjust the brightness of the image, it was discovered that there were details that were only the tenth of the size that could normally be seen in a light microscope. And for the first time, it was actually possible to see little round objects moving along the nerve fiber. These are kinesin. Finally, the traffic within and between cells, this was done in 1981. Finally, this is a picture of a cell with, the kinesin is so small you can't possibly see it. But what they do is they do a preparation which puts fluorescent molecules, and they tend to stick to the kinesin. So this is actually a picture not of the kinesin, but of the cytoskeleton, of the fluorescent molecules that happen to line up along the cytoskeleton. So you can see the cytoskeleton by looking at the fluorescent molecules. Okay, it's sort of an indirect way of seeing it. Finally, the traffic within and between the cells would be a total chaos without elaborate and effective signaling mechanisms. For example, the kinesin motors need to know where to pick up cargo and where to deliver it. So the arrival of the eukaryotic cell brought with it many new innovations. Now we'll look at some of the practical consequences. First, the nucleus helps to protect the genetic code. All eukaryotes have the genetic material in long strands called chromosomes enclosed in a nucleus that is separated from the rest of the cell by a protective membrane. In contrast, prokaryotes, the bacteria, have looped DNA that is not separated from the rest of the cell. The nucleus protects the DNA from damage by contact with food or cell invaders. When the DNA's genes are copied prior to building the various proteins, the genes are processed within the nucleus to remove unneeded information and to correct for copying errors. It's hard, here's, this shows, this came out of a book, the error rates.
Postal Service, 13 late deliveries and 100 parcels. Now that's apparently somebody's...
That's generous.
No, no, let's not be nasty. Any postal workers here? Airline.
You work for the postal?
Yeah. he's going to be mad. He's going to go away. That's Joe, in case you didn't know. He's stomping out now. Airline loading system, one lost bag for 200 bags. Yeah, maybe. Professional typist, one mistake for 250 characters. I don't know, any professional typists here, is that about right? One mistake, that would be like four mistakes and you have to back up. Now that you have computers, I just back up, you know. I don't worry about it.
You
know, spell check. Yeah, spell check. Driving a car in the United States, one death for 10,000 people per year. DNA replication, now we're getting down to DNA, okay, without repair, one mistake for 10 million translations, that's pretty good, that's awfully good. But with repair, it's one per billion. Now, what that really translates to, I understand I have to check this out. I think that means every cell in your body, every second, has one or two errors. Because you do, every cell, there's billions and billions and billions of translations. I think that works out about one or two per second per cell in your body. How many cells do you have in your body?
A gazillion.
Teresa, a few trillion, a few billion, and a few hundred billion, I don't know, something like that.
A lot.
That's right. It's hard to overemphasize. So the eukaryotes do correction of the code, and so, you know, they do much better than the prokaryotes. It's hard to overemphasize how this contrasts with bacteria. The DNA of bacteria come in constant contact with cell contents, and as a result is subject to random deliberate changes of the DNA code itself. That's what viruses are. Viruses basically change the DNA code. They just rub right against the DNA of a bacteria and, you know, insert themselves, and there you go. Bacteria are designed this way because one of the strong points about bacteria is the ability to respond to environmental changes by changing its genetic makeup. Bacteria can even share segments of DNA from other species. But for higher species, the advantage that this might provide is overshadowed by the need to guard the code's accuracy. The code is much more complex and changes are very likely to be unwelcome. So for eukaryotes, the emphasis is on limiting changes to the code and controlling the accuracy when the code is copied. This work takes place within the nucleus. The cytoskeleton also adds structure and dynamic shape to the cell. We already mentioned the role of the cytoskeleton in moving food within the eukaryotic cell, but another important role is to provide structure. Bacteria have simple balloon-like shapes. And I use that word advisedly, balloon, because they're basically just blown up, okay? Circular, sort of a hot sausage size, spiral size, and that's basically it. It's a spiral shape. There are just six basic bacterial shapes, ranging from spheres to rods to spirals. Just as if you were making a balloon, you had basically six different designs you can build a balloon in, okay? If you want to make a balloon with a spiral, you put stresses at certain parts in the along the skin, and then when you blow it up, it'll tend to loop. Okay? Eukaryotic cells have the structure and capabilities of the cytoskeleton. This allows a fantastic range of shapes. This figure just is part of a large chart that shows different single-celled ciliates. A ciliate is a single-celled object that has little hairs that are used for motion or whatever it is. And this is just a small part of the chart. I think the chart had maybe 50 different things, and they numbered them from one, and here's 145. So the whole chart is about six times as big as this. And these are all at the relative scale. And here's the paramecium, you know, the slipper foot thing. That's right there. The cytoskeleton allows very elaborate structures, not available with bacteria. One type of cytoskeleton fiber even has the ability to contract as much like muscle fibers, and this allows the cell shape to respond to stimuli. For example, amoebas can engulf their prey.
Bacteria have no comparable ability. Sometimes in high school biology class, you'll watch an amoeba eating, and they'll just go right around the thing and engulf it. Well, that requires muscles. They have to be able to move, and that requires the cytoskeleton, which you can't see, but it's there. Eukaryotic cells have special organs for specific tasks, such as cilia and a gullet. Gullets are specialized for engulfing food. The cilia aid in movement and also create currents that move the food toward the gullet. We already mentioned mitochondria. They are the power plants of the cell. They energize the cell's metabolism, much as photons provide the energy in photosynthesis. They use oxygen to do this. This is the main reason why eukaryotes consume oxygen. In all, there are perhaps a dozen distinct organelles in a typical cell, each with specific and very vital functions. Since the eukaryotic cell has an efficient way to transport food and waste using kinesin in the cytoskeleton, the cell size can be much larger. For example, some ciliates that we showed pictures of a little ago can be visible to the naked eye, up to a tenth of an inch or so. Bacteria are necessarily small because the main way for food and waste to move about inside a bacterial cell is by ordinary diffusion, the way ink spreads through clear water. The high demands of cell metabolism thus limit the cells to a size that can be adequately served this way, which is quite small. The volume of a typical eukaryotic cell is 10,000 times larger than a typical bacterial cell. On the other hand, because they are larger, some eukaryotic cells are less able to withstand extremes, such as freezing. So size and complexity comes as a price. Signaling is required to coordinate cell movements for food and gathering, for food gathering and digestion, dispatching the kinesin transport motors and other specialized functions that will come later when plants and animals are created, such as for multicellular species, embryo development, and intercellular communications. We'll say much more about signaling in the next talk. Ecological consequences of the creation of eukaryotes. At the start of this period, life on Earth went through continual cycles of boom and bust. Some of these cycles were the result of natural disasters, such as meteorites and ice ages, but there was a basic instability that was caused by the nature of bacteria itself. There are three factors to consider. First, oxygen is a waste product that can poison the bacteria. Once the material in the oceans and the crust were largely oxidized, there was no natural way to remove excess oxygen. Eukaryotes supplied this need because most eukaryote species have mitochondria that burn oxygen. Second, bacteria are relatively inefficient foragers. They are relatively immobile and do not have the body designed to gather and digest food effectively. Third, bacteria are relatively immobile. Some live in immobile colonies, such as the stromatolites, but generally they have a restricted range of motion because they lack the versatile cytoskeleton. In addition, the structure of the eukaryotic cell allows new mobility, leading to greater ability to migrate and avoid dead zones. The ability to have specialized cell structures greatly improves the foraging ability, which makes recycling the ecosystem more efficient. In sum, the eukaryotic cells had a critical role at this point in the Earth's preparation for later life. It was created at the first possible moment after a stable oxygen atmosphere could be maintained, and at a critical moment to avoid stagnation of life in its own wastes. For the next billion years, the first eukaryotic species spread throughout the Earth. Next slide, please. Achieving a balance with bacteria and adding to the stored nutrients. The period ends with the so-called Cambrian explosion, which is a period of great creative intensity, lasting perhaps as little as 5 to 10 million years, during which most of the modern phyla of life appear in the fossil record. It is marked in the fossil record as the first appearance of multicellular species that has skeletal parts. We will begin at that point in the future talk. At the end of this period, the Earth is now a fit place for plants and animals. There is still no significant life in dry land, but the ozone layer filters most harmful rays from the Earth. The Earth is filled with organic nutrients. Every product of one species of life is food for another species, including oxygen. The Earth is now ready to host a stable and enduring life. Why would God create the world in this way? I think part of the answer is that God wants us to learn the details of His creation by examining his creation. He loves to reveal his handiwork, as Psalm 19 states. I believe that God wanted mankind to learn the capabilities and limits of natural development. He does this by creating the world using natural processes when those processes will do the job. He wants us to learn about these natural processes so we can learn both the power and limitations of nature. The fact that some of these natural processes took billions of years is not a problem with God, because he's not limited by time and space. You might ask, why didn't God create a world that could do everything naturally? Why build something that required him to intervene? Well, perhaps one answer is that such a world would have the attributes of God himself. We already hear scientists and philosophers who attribute God-like powers to nature. Mostly, I think, this attribution is based on lack of full information. When you don't know the details or the time scale of some feature, it's easy to say that it must be easy to do, or it can be done by familiar natural undirected forces. But as your knowledge increases, the second argument sounds less reasonable, and so the first, it must be easy to do, becomes the argument of choice, even though we don't know how to do it. But of course, this is just an argument for ignorance, or else it says, in essence, that nature has divine qualities. I suspect that the nature of the Christian faith is such that there will always be contention with secular science, however enlightened both sides become. It's absolutely basic to the Christian faith that God actively participates in his creation. We may not know some of the details, but the fact of God's interest and involvement is basic to our faith. Finally, why didn't I look into these things years ago? For me, this talk forges new territory. For years, I failed to look seriously into the claims of evolution, geology, and the fossil record. I knew, of course, that the common secular view is that these things abundantly prove the theory of natural evolution. Maybe I feared that there was some fatal flaw in my understanding of how God works, and studying these things would shake my faith. The foe seems so strong and noisy when it comes to evolution, and the implications for a godless worldview. Perhaps better to stay ignorant or even wrong about these things in order to protect my faith. Well, by God's grace, my scientific curiosity got the better of me, and I discovered that there is no reason to be defensive when it comes to such matters. Here is how I approach secular science. I try to distinguish between objective, experimental facts and the secular interpretation of the facts. I believe that God has put such a level of basic curiosity into the human soul that even an atheist cannot totally distort the drive of his curiosity. From a lifetime of scientific work, I have come to believe that we can trust the modern scientist when he is doing empirical scientific investigation. Not that he's necessarily right, but because every true scientist opens himself up to critical evaluation. Science is highly competitive, and the key for success is demonstrable proof. This means that it must be possible to verify facts of science by independent investigations of people who do not have an axe to grind. I definitely do not subscribe to a conspiracy theory about science. Oh, sure, there are those noisy atheists who will try to interpret scientific facts to prove their atheistic position. But science as a whole is not conspiratorial. It's too much of a free exchange to be that. Perhaps evolutionary biology or psychology come closest to exercising control over the standard view. But in the long run, most scientists understand that such thought control is self-defeating. There are too many times that the politically correct ideas proves later to be wrong. So I get very distressed by people who hold to a brand of creation science that is radically different from what you hear from established scientists. Not that they hold different views, but because they imply that the only reason their views are not accepted is because of some conspiracy against those views. I have not found this to be so. Let me put this bluntly. If it is indeed true that radically different interpretations of science are the correct ones, then objective scientific proof will smell it out. No scientist can get away with dogmatic claims that fly in the face of impartial objective evidence. That is the marvel of the little itch of eternity that God has placed in every man's heart. Any comments, questions, counterpoints, accusations? Yes?
I must say I like the little net.
You like the little...
Knason motor?
Yeah. Isn't that absolutely amazing? Well, you know, the fact that even a leaf has little motors in it. Any place you have chlorophyll, you got these little motors turning around. And the Knason motor leaf motor is a circular motor. That's the kind we're familiar with. The kinesin motor is what's called a linear motor, because it moves in a line along the microtubules. It's absolutely amazing, utterly amazing. And this has only been known for, what I gave today, 10 years ago, you could not have given this talk. Okay? Because so much has happened in the last 10, 20 years. It's incredible. Yes, John?
You're doing research for a future talk.
Mm-hmm. I have two more talks. The next one is called, maybe more before I die. Maybe two. Lord willing. My next talk is called Natural Creation. My next talk is called Abundant Life. It talks about the explosion of plants and animals in the last 600 million years or 500 million years. And I try to, obviously, give a Christian perspective on that. And the final talk, which will probably be a year from now, is called Natural Creation, which kind of looks at the whole creation process and says, well, how does God, based on the scientific evidence today, how does God go about doing these things? And, of course, I've been giving hints at it all along, but I'll try to wrap it up into one talk.
You're moving in the same direction as the intelligent design movement.
The intelligent design would be layered on top of this, because I have not really tried to get, calculate the probability of something happening. I'm just getting a broad brush picture and saying, look, this happened almost instantaneously, as far as we can tell. Look at how complex this stuff is. The next step would be to go back and do intelligent design, because the intelligent design people are trying to be very scientific and get calculated numbers for various things.
Well, my question is that your research and other people who are moving in this direction, intelligent design, will they be able to get beyond an intelligent agent and prove that it's the Christian God or some sort of other God?
Will
science ever be able to prove the Christian God rather than some deistic God or some other form of creation?
I think that ultimately you can probably demonstrate that the biblical account of creation is reasonable. I doubt very much that you would ever prove from nature that we have the God that is the Christian God. You need to have the revelation of Scripture for that.
So it's possible for the intelligent design movement to maybe win the day over evolution, maybe in a few decades, but everybody's going to find refuge in other interpretations. It won't necessarily all come to a conviction that the Christian God is the God.
My interpretation is God always gives a person the possibility for an out. If they want to say, I don't want to believe in it, it's always possible. I don't think there will ever be categorical proof that the only solution is the Bible solution.
They may only just come to say there's an intelligent agent, they don't know who that is.
Yeah, they don't know who it is, or they still say it's some sort of natural laws which we haven't figured out yet, or something like that. I don't think that, I think that's illustrated in Scripture itself, that God doesn't jam something down your throat. He wants you to willingly come to Him or yield to his persuasion. That's why we need the Holy Spirit. We need the Holy Spirit. We can't, we can't logically get ourselves to heaven. We have to have the witness of the Holy Spirit inside us, drawing us to Him. And I believe that very firmly. And I think that what will happen is the barrier, if you have a scientist who might be open to the guiding of the Holy Spirit, but he is his head is turned by all the claims of evolution and so forth, I think that person will be able to see a reasonable way to keep his scientific integrity and still believe in the God of the Bible. But it won't prove it in the sense that you can't believe anything else.
Will your future talks talk about whether there really was a Garden of Eden or whether
there definitely was a Garden of Eden. No question.
There was a special creation.
That would see. One of the problems I have is this talk I covered 4 billion years. There's only so much I can talk about in one talk. Yeah. And the next talk is going to be jam-packed. You ought to have a totally separate talk about the creation of humans. Okay? And what happened then. And there's lots to be said about that, but I will not have it in the next two talks.
Okay.
Maybe if you really annoy me enough, I might actually give another thought. 2 years from now. A year and a half from now. But yeah, there actually was a need.